Okay. Well, I have a bit of a challenge for me. I think that's what every Blackboard speaker has to say. That's a challenge to give this talk, because those of you who know me is that I'm usually working in numerical simulations of galaxy formation. So usually I show some computer movies and using PowerPoint for the last 8 years or so. So going back to the Blackboard is a kind of new experience for me. On the other hand side, I think my task here for the day is not to show results, but rather to raise issues we want to discuss over the next 3 months. And I want to do that starting from two different angles. First, from the angle of cosmology, looking downscale, and next, from the galaxy perspective, looking upscale, and then see how those two different topics may merge. Cosmology has been tremendously successful over the last 10 years. So I remember I was here in 1995 at a galaxy formation workshop, and essentially we knew, well, the matter density of the universe to within a factor of 10 or so. No one was talking about the cosmological constant. The Hubble constant still was uncertain to within a factor of 2 or so. And nowadays, barely 10 years later, we usually refer to a standard model of cosmology or concordance model of cosmology. And this model can in short be described by four parameters. First, and we always love the letter omega as, so yeah, just define it as a ratio of the density of some stuff x with respect to the density it would need to close the universe, so to get a universe which is barely expanding forever. And in this model, we find all the matter in the universe to add up to about 30% of this critical density. We have this mysterious cosmological constant, which adds up to the rest to make the universe to be one of flat space-time, space geometry. We have measured the expansion rate of the universe, usually expressed in terms of the Hubble constant, to be 70 kilometers per second and megaparsec. And everything we know and love, baryons, add up to no more than 0.04%. So essentially, these are the numbers who describe not only the present state of the universe, but also the evolution of the universe, at least over the past few billion years. We actually can go even further if we specify what this difference is between the baryons and the total mass in the universe. It's usually referred to some type of dark matter. And if you make one particular assumption for this dark matter, so-called cold dark matter, so some type of non-baryonic species as envisioned by many theories of particle physics, then we can expand on this and actually find a model which is in agreement with quite an impressive array of astronomical observations. Let me just start and list nine of them. First, it's the age of the universe. We have a model which at least ensures that the oldest star in the universe is not older than the universe itself, but younger than it. Secondly, the extragalactic distance scale itself. Third, we can reproduce the abundance of light elements, so-called primordial elements. I will elaborate on that in a few minutes. We can get the amplitude that is observed in the cosmic microwave background radiation, so to speak, the afterglow of the Big Bang, where we see some little wriggles, which we can statistically quantify and set in relation to our cosmological model, we can explain the abundance of galaxy clusters. We can reproduce the clustering of galaxies. Some of you have seen that picture of the so-called cosmic web, that galaxies are not randomly distributed in space, but assemble along a filamentary network structure. So we can account for the clustering in the correlation function, in the shape as well as in the amplitude. We can reproduce large-scale motions of galaxies, coherent motions of galaxies. We reproduce the observed geometry of the space as measured by type 1 supernova on the one hand side and by microwave background experiments on the other. And if we add another assumption, namely that the baryons cum cranosalis trace the overall distribution of dark matter, then we can reproduce to remarkable detail the properties of the so-called Lyman alpha forest absorption of we observe in the spectra of distant quasar due to intervening gas. I think this whole set impresses not only by its pure number, but also by the dynamical range that's covered. Say, in order to go from light element synthesis to the present day universe, you essentially cover cosmic ages from 1 second to 4 × 10^17 seconds. If you want to reproduce, say, the Lyman alpha forest with its properties to structures we observe in the microwave background, you cover a spatial range ranging from 1 megaparsec out to something like 10 gigaparsec. And if you translate the whole thing in masses, you essentially reproduce all astronomical objects observed on scales or on mass scales larger than, say, the Milky Way. Everything that's smaller scaled, we don't really know yet, mainly because many of these observations, either we cannot go to smaller scales, like, for example, for microwave background experiments, just due to the sensitivity of the experiments, or just physics gets too complicated to directly map observations to theoretical models, something we're going to work on in this workshop. So let me go back to one of those numbers, just in a bit more detail to explain on it, this total number of baryons, 4%, as opposed to the total number of matter in the universe, say 30% of this critical density. How do we get there? And this number, we essentially can derive using four different observational techniques. The first one, and probably the oldest one, is nuclear synthesis, or primordial nuclear synthesis. The question goes back to where does all the deuterium in the universe comes from? And deuterium, as we know in later stages, during stellar processing, is usually destroyed. But we observe some. And we observe some if we go to the very high redshift, very young universe. Actually, we observe deuterium at an abundance of about 3 × 10^-5 in mass. On the other hand side, we measure the density of the universe and the temperature of the microwave background. And with the temperature of the microwave background, we know, just from statistical mechanics, how many photons we have in our universe. So we can calculate, if we extrapolate that back to early phases when the universe was denser and hotter than in its present stage, we can calculate the nuclear balance between the creation and destruction of, for example, deuterium. And if we change the amount of baryons, we change the nuclear balance and shift it. So essentially, by measuring the abundance of deuterium, we fix how many baryons there can be in the universe. If you do this in more detail and plug in the 3 × 10⁻⁵ in mass abundance, you get that 0.04 number. Meanwhile, we have a second equally accurate method to measure the baryon abundance in the universe, and that is the microwave background. So what do you see in this fluctuation you observe in the microwave background? You observe sound waves or acoustic oscillations. And so you can draw the analogy between, say, the microwave background and an acoustic oscillator, or an harmonic oscillator. If you do this analogy, then the amount of dark matter essentially determines the depth of your potential wells. And the amount of baryons determines your mass loading on your spring. So essentially, you have the spring constant due to the dark matter and the mass on the spring due to the baryons. And then you look at the oscillation spectrum of your harmonic oscillator and compare that with observations, and you can calculate the ratio of dark matter to baryons. And you get essentially the same number. You get about 0.04 in baryons if you assume a dark matter of 0.3. Third, you can use the so-called Lyman alpha force again, the absorption of gas intervening our view towards quasar at high redshift. So essentially, we measure how much absorption there is, and with some reasonable assumption on the density of the matter, essentially something around the average density of the universe, the temperature of the gas, and the strength of UV sources like stars and quasars, we can measure the average opacity, or calculate the average opacity of the Lyman alpha forest, and from that infer how many baryons there are. The number we get is again this 0.04. Again, it's interesting to realize the dynamic range we cover with those three methods. The first, nuclear synthesis, we did MEV physics, nuclear physics, at an age when the universe was 1 second old. With the second one, the microwave background, we look at the universe when it had something like an age of about 300,000 years. And we look at electron volt scale physics, acoustic waves, atomic physics. And finally, with the Lyman alpha forest, again, we look at atomic physics, but at an age when the universe was a couple of billion years old. And all the three methods give you the same number. So that certainly is remarkable. However,
so you know this number to within 10% or so?
To within 10% or so, yeah. Actually, even better than within 10%. Actually, I should make one constraint here. This 0.04 in the Lyman alpha forest is measured at a redshift of 3, corresponding to an universe of age of a few billion years, not as the present day. If you do the same exercise at the present day, you get a considerably smaller number. So somewhere, somehow, these baryons, which we see in the Lyman alpha forest at redshift 3, are no longer visible there in the present-day universe. There are some theories where they may have gone, which gain in credibility due to some recent observation. But certainly, this is one problem we here at this workshop have to worry about. Namely, where are, at the present day, all those baryons? Also, I should note, you could ask the same, say, a different question. If we are not looking in absorption, but more in emission, we just look at the total amount of starlight we observe in the local universe. For example, just by integrate over every star and every galaxy we observe in the Milky Way, we get a number for this which is roughly 1/20th of this number, 0.02. So only the smallest fraction of these baryons actually make it into visible objects like stars.
Is that 1/20th assuming an IMF so that there are stars?
You have to make some assumption.
That you don't actually see the light from?
Yeah, you actually have to make some assumption on how you transform, say, light you observe into mass of the underlying object, which has some uncertainties, of course. On the other hand side, you can do another exercise, again at the present day, right, at the present day. Maybe you look at X-ray emitting galaxy clusters, the most massive objects you observe in the universe, most massive bound objects you observe in the local universe. So you measure X-ray emission. X-ray emission is essentially density squared times some coefficients for Bremsstrahlung. That's what you observe. You integrate your galaxy cluster inside out, so you know the total amount of stuff which is emitting, namely X-rays. You also can measure the temperature of the gas from inside out. So you measure with that, if you assume equilibrium, the depth of the potential well. By comparing those two numbers, you get a ratio of baryons in the sense of emitting gas over total matter in the sense of gravitating stuff. And you get the same ratio of about 15% you get with those two numbers. But there's one important piece to this argument, namely that a galaxy cluster is representative for the cosmic max. And why should that be the case? And the argument is fairly simple, and that makes it so strong. You have a galaxy cluster which has velocities of the order of thousands of kilometers per second. So if you measure it out to, say, a few kiloparsec, few megaparsec, this corresponds to the distance you can travel with 1,000 kilometers per second over the whole Hubble time. So kind of you have a causally connected region, and everything outside is not in causal contact. So therefore, you cannot, say, mix stuff in and out in substantial properties, because you just have no time to do so. So when you measure a galaxy cluster and go, and that's the important piece, go to sufficiently large radii, you measure a representative piece of the universe. So we come to the conclusion from a number of physical and astrophysical arguments that about 4% of the stars in the universe are in baryons, or say 15% of the matter in the universe are in baryons. And you may argue, well, it's a second order effect. Why should I bother about them? I mean, cosmology, as I said, is solved. We explain everything on scales larger than a megaparsec. Why worry about baryons? And I think there are mainly four reasons to do so. The first one goes very back to the success story of this cosmological model. It appears that if you go to scales substantially smaller than 1 megaparsec, then the agreement between the prediction of that model and what you observe is no longer good. It actually seems to be discrepant. I will give a few examples later. So the standard model of cosmology has serious problems accounting for galactic and subgalactic structures we are observing. And as I will outline in a second, these are the scales where baryons, where this measly little 4% actually do matter. Secondly, as I will also explain in a few minutes, baryons are transformed into stars. And stars shine, and stars explode, at least some of them, as supernovae. And there is a considerable amount of energy related to this process, essentially nuclear energy. So you have a quite substantial source of energy which you can spill into the baryons of the universe. I will quantify that in a moment. Third, as soon as you explode a supernova, you spill metals in the environment. And the amount of metals and the detailed composition of the metals tell you something how stars have formed in different objects throughout the history of the universe. So you know how objects we observe have, or you can trace how objects we observe may have been formed. And finally, if we go back to densities, and I should put here a number, at present day, this is 10 to minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter in total mass, so baryon is 4% of that number. If you have densities as low as these, for all atomic processes, time scales get fairly long. They get in the scales of giga years and longer. So the system called intergalactic medium, or Lyman alpha forest, is no longer in strict thermodynamical equilibrium. We get time-dependent effects. That makes it difficult to analyze. On the other hand, the virtue is that the initial conditions are still somewhere visible in the present state of the intergalactic medium. So you can use the intergalactic medium to see how the intergalactic medium has been heated, how metals have been distributed to it, and finally, how the universe started to shine, how you go from the so-called dark ages, the universe just full of baryons but no star, and probably mostly neutral, to universe as we observe today, full of stars and galaxies, and the IGM mostly in a highly ionized state. So that brings me down to the scales of galaxies. And I think for the non-experts, I just start with a few comments on what kind of units we are used to when we look at galaxies. And one example is our very own Milky Way. So typical mass of the Milky Way in baryons or in stars is something like 6 times 10 to 10 solar masses. And a typical velocity is that stars like the Sun orbit the galactic center at about, say, 220 kilometers per second, and has a distance to, like the Sun has a distance, to the galactic center of about 8.5 kiloparsec. Actually, those three numbers are not independent from each other. We actually don't really know quite precisely what the distance of the Sun to the galactic center is. It's probably smaller than this 8.5 kiloparsec if it is smaller, resulting in a velocity which is smaller, resulting in a mass that's smaller. So there's a considerable uncertainties in these numbers. But the one thing, if you now try to map galaxies to cosmology, is a nice coincidence of units. 1 kilometer per second roughly corresponds to 1 kiloparsec per giga year. It's actually accurate to a few percent. So this number tells you that our very own Sun, over the age of the universe, would have been formed right at the beginning of the universe, would rather something like a distance of 3 megaparsec. Or another way to look at it if we really say, okay, the objects we observe are objects with velocities in the range of tens or hundreds, maybe a few thousand kilometers per second, or temperatures of 10 to 4, 10 to 5, maybe 10 to 8 Kelvin, if you go to the hottest galaxy clusters, you're getting distances you can travel over the age of the universe of, say, something like 10 megaparsec. So if we say, okay, these baryons behave different to the dark matter, but started from identical initial conditions, then scales where things may look different are scales of, say, a few megaparsec and below. We can apply this argument to our very own Milky Way. And for example, plot the speed at which stars in the Milky Way rotate versus the distance to the galactic center, and we become the famous so-called flat rotation curves. So the rotation curve stays constant, arguing that if the mass of the Milky Way somewhere stops at distance of about 30 kiloparsec, so the self-gravitating mass of the Milky Way would drop off with r to the minus 1/2, we would need something like a component to compensate this drop-off, usually accounted to the dark matter. So the current wisdom is that if you go to very large distances, you measure the dark halo of our Milky Way, whereas in the inside, the baryons play a more important role. Can we quantify the role of the baryons a bit more? And actually, we can. Let me do this in the following way. From two perspectives, again, one as an observer, just looking at the data I measure for the galaxy, and secondly, as a theorist, trying to explain how galaxies form. So first, from the observational perspective, I know if something is in centrifugal equilibrium, then its velocity square is given by mgm over r. And I can plug in the numbers I have here for the Milky Way, the velocity and its distance. So I get the mass I measure gravitationally within the orbit of the Milky Way to be something like, you plug in the number, you get 9 times 10 to 10 solar masses. That's probably an upper bound, because as I mentioned, this number is probably smaller, resulting in a smaller velocity, and therefore also resulting in a smaller mass here.
That's the mass at what distance?
This is the mass at 8.5 encircled by a sphere of radius 8.5 kiloparsec, so-called solar circle. I compare that with the mass of the disk, which I observe, and again, I restrict myself to what's inside 8.5 kiloparsec. This is about 5 times 10 to 10 solar masses. So all the stars, all the gas I observe in the Milky Way pretty much accounts to half of the mass which I observe dynamically. And actually, it may well be that there is no real difference between those two masses if I lower those constraints a bit. So, in other words, if I go to galaxies and look inside galaxies, there's fairly little room for dark matter. Say the cores of galaxies are at least considerably contributed by baryons. Can I do a similar argument based on theory? And I actually can. Going back to the very question, why do galaxies rotate? And the picture we have in mind is, it's just because the universe is not homogeneous. So we have a region in space which eventually is going to collapse from a galaxy, And this region is tidally torqued by surrounding material. And these tidal torques make this object spin. Of course, you can imagine tidal torques do something, but they're usually weak. So what you manage to do with tidal torques is that you get a slow rotator. So your galaxy, or your will-be galaxy, before it's going to collapse, has a rotation speed typically like 1/10 of the speed you would need to be in rotation support. So if your baryons rotate at 1/10 of the speed, and suddenly they start some processes like cooling, they give up their energy by transforming it internally in radiation, the gas is going to collapse. And while it's collapsing, it's going to spin up. And it will be spinning up by a factor of 10. Going again to this number, I said, OK, the Milky Way traveled some 3 megaparsec over the age of the universe. Compare those 3 megaparsec with 2πr, you get an r of about 400 kiloparsec. So that is a kind of the radius which is in causal contact. And if you collapse that by a factor of 10, you end up with an object which has 40 kiloparsec the radius. A bit on the high side, but typical for, say, object like the Milky Way, which probably has a radius of something like 30 kiloparsec. So you take the whole mass and compress it to a volume 1/10 its size. Or you amplify the density by a factor 10 cubed, factor 1,000. And immediately, you realize your small fraction of 4% immediately start being of the same order of magnitude, if not larger than the dark matter. So I already mentioned here, for our Milky Way, we cannot have more than, say, a few 10 to 10 solar masses of dark matter, say, within the solar circle. You now can ask the question, OK, let's do my cosmology. Let's run models of structure formation, say, forming objects, collapsed objects of dark matter. And you look at those objects, which give you potential depths of 220 kilometers per second. How much dark matter do those models have in the inner regions, in the inner, say, 10 kiloparsec or so? And you get a number which is, say, on the high side of this. It's probably more like 10 to 11 solar masses. Showing one of the problems we have. If we believe our standard model of cosmology, we're getting more mass in galaxies like the Milky Way than we observe. And the argument I made here was a lower bound, because I have not included the effect that the baryons we have will pull on the dark matter and will pull it inwards. So we'll have even more dark matter than what you would get from large-scale structure simulation.
Dark matter, you get too much baryons.
Oh, you're dominated by baryons. And you get, this is observed. We know the Milky Way has 5 times 10 to 10 solar masses of stars. We know from the rotations there can be only another 5 times 10 to 10. However, if you do cosmology, you would expect a larger number. For something
number
of dark matter. For something does not fit here. This is related to another problem. When you look at the structure of those collapsed objects, so-called dark matter halos, these objects, and ask, what is the density? How is the density stratified in those objects? The density increases towards the center, and it essentially increases without bounds. You get a slope of r to the minus 1 near the center. Now, let's compare that with observation. And you say, OK, how can I do that? I have baryons, I have dark matter, I have a complicated system, which I don't understand. So let's go to one particular class of galaxies, namely so-called low surface brightness galaxies. Galaxies which just turn out to have very few baryons near the center. Because they have very few baryons, the baryons cannot, say, majorly mix up the dynamics of the dark matter. And you find that these objects actually have a core. So observations of so-called low surface brightness galaxies gives you rho is about constant for r goes to 0. Whereas theory, that means the lambda CDM model, says rho goes like something like r to minus 1.
Is there a simple analytical explanation of what over r?
No.
It's just numerical?
There are more say, tests,
yeah. Say, okay, let's go in a bit more detail. What you observe is, if you plot rho versus r, is something which at the smallest scale goes to r to the minus 1, at intermediate scale is r to the minus 2, and at large scale goes like r to the minus 3. For r to the minus 2, we kind of understand, or is at least a preferred solution, is a kind of isothermal situation. That you go steeper at large radii, you can understand because you have to get stuff in. You certainly see that you have a boundary and you have to agree to matter. This r to minus 1 is essentially not fully understood. It's the way how I usually think.
There's a fourth state.
Yeah.
R minus 3 doesn't convert.
OK. At some point, yeah, it's right. At some point, you have to say, OK, this is my VC times age of the universe. I mean, that is the one thing. We live in a finite age universe. That makes things sometimes a bit complicated. The way how I usually think of this r to the minus 1 is that you have angular momentum, so you have orbits, so particles avoid the center because they have angular momentum. So that way, you can get something like a depression. You don't understand the r to the minus 1 with that, but you understand why you may run shallower than r to the minus 2 near the center.
I don't follow that argument. It's well known that if you had a purely isothermal halo with singular boundary conditions at the origin, VR to the minus 2, or if you
simulate that particular situation numerically, you find that you get a radial orbit instability, and you again get an r to minus 1 profile.
You're talking about something added.
Yeah. So somehow, as soon as you get angular momentum, either explicit one, net angular momentum, but it may even be a symmetry breaking. Some particles go that way, some particles go around that way. You depress the density near the center. OK. So we have one problem. If you look just at the Milky Way and the mass balance, we can look at so-called low surface brightness galaxies, getting a different problem. And there's a third one. If you just look, again, objects, galaxy size, like the local group. The local group consists of two major galaxies, namely Andromeda and the Milky Way, and a number of smaller galaxies, so-called dwarf galaxies, Magellanic clouds, and things like that. And if you count all your satellites, you find about 40 down to velocities of 10 kilometers per second. Again, if you run a model, cold dark matter, starting from these conditions, you end up not with 40 satellites, but with 1,000 satellites. So again, there is a discrepancy, quite considerable one. And of course, you may ask the question, well, what could explain this discrepancy? Now, if you talk about 10 kilometers per second, you're talking about temperature in the area of a few 10 to 4 Kelvin. And as I will explain in a sec, these temperatures may not be very difficult to explain if you add baryonic processes like star formation, supernova, and so on. So maybe what happens, maybe, because we don't know, that you form stars, the stars heat the gas and blow out the gas and make, say, a fair fraction of the satellites dim. Or you heat the gas before these objects collapse in the first place, so you prevent the gas from falling in and forming stars in the first place. Okay, let me go to this argument of the energy or temperature in the intergalactic medium. How could, or what can stars do, stars that form out of the baryons, do to the baryons? And the argument roughly goes as follows. We have 4% of the universe in baryons at the present day. We have in stars something like 1/20th of that number. So when you form one solar mass of stars, then every 100th star, or every 100th solar mass, will be in a star sufficiently massive to explode as a supernova. Each supernova puts 10 to 51 ergs into the intergalactic medium. So from this number, you can calculate how many stars you have, you can calculate how many supernova you have, and in the ideal world, you just homogeneously mix those over all the baryons there are, and can calculate how much energy there is in the baryons, or calculate the temperature of these baryons. The number you get, if you put in typical numbers, is something like 3 million degrees, or 220 kilometers per second. So in principle, all the energy you produce in supernovae are sufficient to substantially affect objects as massive as the Milky Way. Of course, we don't know how those objects interact. We don't know how efficient the energy we form in supernova is channeled into the ISM. So it may well be that you have a hot background of cosmic rays, for example, which does nothing to the baryons, or very little. Or you have a high energy gamma ray tail where some of the energy is hidden. But the beauty, because it's a global argument, this energy has to be somewhere. And if you even take a small fraction and put it in the baryons, then you do PDV work or shocks, and you can substantially affect the distribution of baryons. No, I just took the energy which is in kinetic energy of supernova, 10 to 51 ergs.
There's actually much more in neutrinos, but they don't.
Yeah, it's another factor of 100 in neutrinos. If you could tap even that resource.
Are you saying that a neutrino, well, still, it's an amazing number. Neutrino, the kinetic
energy of
a neutrino is 100 times the kinetic energy of all the galaxies.
Yeah. You could, of course, use the same kind of argument to estimate, well, how many metals should there be in the universe? Again, the argument is, you have one solar mass of stars, you have 1/100th of a solar mass in a star that goes supernova. This star will take 10% of its mass and transform it in metals more massive than, say, including carbon. And when the star explodes, these metals are spread to the intergalactic medium. Average that over your 0.04 baryons and calculate what the average metallicity of the stuff should be, and you end up with a number of something like 10 to minus 3 solar. A bit less than 10 to minus 3 solar. So 1/1000th of the solar metallicity, you should find pretty much, if it's homogeneously spread, you should find pretty much everywhere in the universe. So we have the energy and the metals to substantially affect all the barons in the universe. The question is how these processes work. And we actually don't understand, even in rough detail, don't understand how these processes work. It's also a challenge because another observation I mentioned is we have the Lyman alpha forest.
Have people done simulations with these bursts of energy? And
yeah. Andrea, for example, has quite a number of them. There are actually quite some numerical problems also to have to deal with. So you have to be very careful not to say induce a new effect just by the way how you implement these explosions in the simulations. But the challenge now
of dynamic range, you want to resolve small scale where these explosions occur within galaxy, but you also want to study the large scale effect, and so it's far from trivial.
So let me again go to the intergalactic medium. Right at the beginning I said, well, our cosmological model works beautifully and we explain quite a range of properties of the so-called Lyman alpha forest if we make the assumption that the baryons trace the cosmic web. The baryons trace pretty much the dark matter. Now it turns out that elements like, for example, carbon 4 have an ionization potential very similar to H1, oscillator strengths also similar to H1. So carbon 4 pretty much traces the density distribution of the intergalactic medium as well as hydrogen does, only you have substantially fewer carbon 4 due to the metallicity of the gas. So you find carbon 4 pretty much in every system where you should be, in principle, be able to detect it, corresponding to a metallicity of about, say, 1 part in 1,000 compared to solar. So essentially, this picture seems to be conclusive. You take the metals you form and spread them evenly over the intergalactic medium, or at least distribute them over the intergalactic medium that you observe them everywhere you look at. But on the other hand side, how do you get the metals out there? And actually, you have the velocities. Yeah, with a 200-kilometer kick, you can cover regions as big as a couple of megaparsecs. So you also have the mechanism to get the metals out. But how do you take the metals out, take the energy you have, get the metals out, and still can claim that the baryons trace the dark matter? How do you do that without screwing up the distribution of all the baryons? There's another argument that this very effect that you take metals out of the galaxy may actually be important. And that is if you look at abundances in the X-ray emitting gas of galaxy clusters. This gas in galaxy clusters is observed to have metallicities something like 1/3 of the solar metallicity, to name a ballpark number. But there's roughly 5 times as much gas in the intercluster medium than there are stars in the galaxies that belong to that particular galaxy cluster. And wherever we look at gas, the highest metallicities we find are about 2 solar. We rarely find abundances higher than twice the abundance we observe for the sun. If you compare those numbers, that indicates if you want to account for the metallicity we observe in a galaxy cluster, each galaxy must have lost 50% of its gas, or 50% of its mass. So each galaxy forms stars, enriches the intergalactic medium to twice solar, and then loses 50% of its mass. How does a galaxy survive such a violent event? And if it's not surviving, how do you get the metals out in the intercluster medium? So it overall, if you look at the energy balance point of view, it all looks right. We have a large enough reservoir to account for all these observations. But the question really is, how do you do it and still get galaxies that look like equilibrium galaxies to have a Lyman alpha force, which look like as if it would trace the cosmic web and so on? So it's really a matter of understanding this overall process, at least at some detail. The final thing I want to address, again, this time going to the intergalactic medium, is one I already mentioned, namely that the density in this intergalactic medium is low enough. So you have non-equilibrium processes, or in other words, you have a way how to memorize the initial conditions from which your intergalactic medium started with. If you get it in the IGM. That is, and I think that's really a big question. What fraction of that huge reservoir you have out there can you actually tap in? So
I think what he's saying is just because it's a non-equilibrium process doesn't mean that you learn about the initial conditions. The memory can be lost.
The memory can be lost if you have other strong processes, yeah. So essentially, you have this complicated mixture of effects, and you want to essentially get it to a consistent story. So, the program really put down in four lines of what we want to work on while we are here the next 3 months is, first of all, of course, is the connection between the evolution of individual galaxies and the evolution of the intergalactic medium. That's the title of the workshop. How we can put this together to a consistent picture. This will have a follow-up question, namely, how has the intergalactic medium been enriched with metals? And be enriched with metals and still maintaining a structure which looks like as if it would have been undisturbed. Maybe it is undisturbed, but maybe it just looks like that. Something we have to work on. Certainly will not answer it finally over the next 3 months. Can we then use galaxies and the intergalactic medium to constrain what has been the thermal history of the universe? How has the intergalactic medium been heated up? Can we essentially trace back the origin of all of that to the very transition from the universe when there was no star there yet to a universe which is, as it appears now, highly ionized? What are the sources responsible for this ionization? Are the supernovae, for example, are the stars? It's also an important number to keep in mind. I always say supernovae, but you can do the exercise and find that pretty much the same energy you put in supernovae, you also create over the lifetime of a massive stars in photoionizing radiation. So how all these different effects work together? That's pretty much our agenda for the next 3 months.
Most of what you're doing, I suppose, is assuming the standard model. But there are, I know there are people who said that these bounds are so great that you have to change the standard form.
That would be, say, if we cannot get it together, that may be a conclusion we have to draw, that we may have to dismiss the standard model, at least on the smallest scale.
Which standard model are you referring to, cosmology or particle?
No, I mean
cosmology.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, for example, one way you may change the behavior on the smallest scale is that you change the physics of your cold dark matter particle, making it collisional, for example, or making it warm and not cold. And so there are a number of proposals what you can do from the particle physics side to change the picture.
There can't be a lot of change. It has to be restricted to the small scales that haven't been so well matched by large-scale observations. So self-interacting dark matter may still have a place.
You have to do it on megaparsec
dark
scale.
Matter, yeah. But it has to be on scales sort of below a megaparsec, which is far below.
Well, you know, people calculate it, but then it doesn't really work. Like, all this modification of that matter actually so far failed. We don't have any kind of alternative.
Well, I think people haven't really tried. I mean, let's
face it, right? No? Dark matter, self-interacting dark matter, people spend years, nothing comes.
May I disagree?
There's no simple decision.
May I disagree?
Well, I mean, self-interacting dark matter happens not to be a serious change to cold dark matter, except in details of the small scale, which are precisely why it's invented. So. Warm dark matter is a more violent change. Warm dark matter won't form enough early halos to form enough reionization early enough, and you know, there are bigger problems with that. But self-interacting is sort of details which are probably unacceptable, but it's not as well worked out.
I agree with you that there's lots of things yet to do in that respect. But particle physics and cosmology used to be kind of a simple solution. Dark matter, okay, we have this problem with radiation curve and blah, 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 and we can't do anything. Not to say you can, I have another particle, bump, and it just opens the whole field, right? And main solution, very nice, kind of, it doesn't solve the whole details, but you can, on a gross scale, fix it there. Right? So we try it with a different particles now, and we say, okay, now does it make a breakthrough, at least, or something? It doesn't. Right? Let's face it.
And actually, if you look at the parameter space of potential dark matter masses, cross-section, and so on, the ones that really have been explored are tiny, tiny bits of this parameter space.
I think we need to turn it upside down, which is to say the better we get at using cold dark matter to explain things, the more restrictive we should be about the allowed dark matter. And we haven't spent as much time translating our successes with the cold dark matter model into constraints on the nature of the particle physics alternatives. They can get tighter over time, and that would be an interesting way to look at it.
Before dark matter is actually discovered somewhere.
Well, this is, but you know, the problem is most of those experiments are sort of looking for the key under the lamppost. If the dark matter has a certain likelihood, then they'll be able to detect it. If it's not that kind of dark matter, it's not right there, inclusive.
Any other questions?
Sir, I have a really stupid question. I just want to get a rough picture of the rough picture you have of, let's say, our galaxy.
Yep.
So say the baryonic diameter of a galaxy is 1.
Yeah.
Firstly, what is the length scale for the dark matter surrounding our galaxy?
That would be then 20 in those units.
Okay. And the mass?
See, the picture, I think if you put it in, say, terms of, say, the Milky Way Andromeda system, then, say, the two dark halos of the Milky Way and the Andromeda would touch each other. Yeah. So the dark matter halos, at least in these frameworks, are pretty darn big.
And can you said this in your talk, but can you tell me again, why is the why is baryonic matter so much more concentrated than the dark matter?
Well, the baryons, the important thing about the baryons is that they can cool. Yeah? So essentially, you have, say, two atoms, they collide. Mm-hmm. That way, you ionize it by collision. And then they recombine, and the piece of radiation is radiated away. So you take energy out of kinetic motion and transform it into radiation, which is much more difficult to absorb or putting back into this reservoir. So you have your gas, it's cooling. And when it's cooling, it has no pressure, so it's collapsing. It's collapsing until angular momentum can keep it up. That's a rough picture. Yeah, so the galaxy initially started with something which was as big as half the way to Andromeda and collapsed by a factor of 20 to form, say, a disk of the present size.
And the dark matter is maintained in this radius because it's orbiting or because there's some sort of pressure?
It's a kind of kinetic pressure because they're moving, the dark matter moves at say, 200 kilometers per second. Whereas the gas, it would have, it's collisionless. Therefore, say, dark matter streams cross each other. Whereas the gas shocks and gets rid of that energy and therefore has to collapse to the very center.
So the dark matter is not spinning faster
no.
to keep it at
all? No. It's a kind of pressure.
And sorry, one last question.
Yeah?
All the dark matter in the universe is presumed is around galaxies? Or there's some intergalactic stuff?
There's probably most of it will be intergalactic.
Okay.
Yeah. But we don't know. We haven't measured it. So we see it due to its gravity in the Milky Way. And we see it, say, if we look at large-scale streams of galaxies, the galaxies moving around, we can conclude that there has to be some attractor and can limit the amount of dark matter from that way.
At least in the case of clusters of galaxies, you directly see the intergalactic baryons that are much more abundant than the galactic baryons.
Yeah. That you see that fact, not quite that factor, but you see a bit of it, yeah.
Well, that's very much.